United States v. James. Ms. Johnson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honor, the main portion of Mr. James's argument before you today is that that certain errors in the jury instructions prevented the jury from receiving a fair and accurate summary of the relevant law in his case. I'm going to start with the no adverse inference instruction simply because I believe that it presents a somewhat interesting conceptual argument about what the jury, what impression the jury receives when the jury is advised that a particular individual does not have to testify versus being instructed that in general defendants do not have to testify.
But I don't understand, at least in the context of this case, why it's all that important. It's not like the jury was sitting there looking at 10 or 15 different defendants and the judge is singling out, you know, defendants A, B, and C, you know, you don't draw an adverse inference, but the rest of them, you know, infer away. Here, you know, there's one person sitting there and the judge says the defendant. It just seems very unlikely to me that the jury would place any weight at all in the use of the definite versus the indefinite article.
Well, I think it could be misleading if the jurors are not familiar with the law. And
well, say, don't draw any adverse inference against this man.
Well, I think it
give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, whatever.
I think it puts into the jurors' minds questions about. I think it might produce the opposite effect than the prophylactic effect that the instruction is intended to produce, which is specifically it makes jurors start wondering, well, why doesn't he have to testify? What is it about this particular defendant that he has the right not to testify?
Whereas if the judge explains that, I mean, actually, I don't know. I mean, especially when you assume the jurors follow the instructions they're given and all the rest of the things, as you well know, I don't see that. I just wanted also to ask you about one of your other points in the hopes of maybe focusing what we have here. Given the fact that the evidence in this case, taken in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, looks very strong to support the proposition that Mr. James possessed the weapon in conjunction with the drug trafficking offense, that's enough, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter really whether the evidence was very weak about his transportation or his carrying, because the statute since post-Bailey has included possession.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that when you combine the other errors that the defendant presents with the fact that the jurors were provided an instruction about transportation, where
It would have been enough. I mean, the government argues that this is one of those instances where there's an or in the statute, and it was enough for the 924C to show either carrying or possession, and I'm not wild about the carrying argument, but it seems to me the evidence on possession is very strong, and so I don't know why it helps you to take this in conjunction with other errors. If one of your other points is enough for reversal, it's enough regardless of this issue. But I just don't see. Do you have any response to the fact that this jury could have found possession in connection with a drug trafficking crime?
No, Your Honor. My argument is simply the totality of the jury instructions as a whole were not an accurate reflection of the law.
Why doesn't Turner control here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, if you could refresh my recollection in regard to Turner.
Well, when a jury returns a guilty verdict on an indictment that charges several acts in the conjunctive, the verdict will stand if the, you know, evidence is sufficient with respect to any one of the acts that have been charged. And here there was certainly sufficient evidence to find that he possessed the guns in relation to a drug crime. So what I'm wondering is, why should it matter that the jury was also instructed in the on the carry prong?
Your Honor, and again, it, my argument is a totality argument in connection with the jury instructions as a whole. In fact, I don't have a direct response in connection with that specific instruction. I'm specifically focusing on the fact that that carrying or transporting error when combined with the additional jury instruction errors created a general lack of a fair and accurate summary of the law in this case. So, but to directly answer your question, I believe that Turner does apply in this case, and that if the only error that I was presenting was that one, then I certainly would have a much weaker argument than I'm presenting in connection with the totality of the jury instructions.
The government argued as well that you failed to preserve your argument about the Ash Street evidence below, and that we should, you know, be reviewing for plain error. Was the argument made below? And, you know, will we find that in the record?
I believe that the Ash Street objection was preserved. I know that the government argued that my indication to the trial judge that I wanted certain jury instructions, and then my failure to object during the actual reading of the jury instructions for some reason did not preserve my ability to or result in forfeiture. But I would disagree with that. I would suggest that when I instructed, or when I requested these instructions, and the district court judge denied the instructions, that based upon the culture of the court, it is not that the district court judge would not then require me to interrupt him during the presentation of the jury instructions themselves to reassert the objection. And
but you know, there's a slight problem with that, because you might ask for instructions and the district judge then refuse, and then when the district judge finally comes up with the last version of the instructions, maybe he has sufficiently incorporated your thought that you're not dissatisfied with it. How will he know if you don't say something?
Actually, when he came up with the final version, I would have to recheck, but my recollection is that when he came up with the final version, I continued to preserve my prior requests and objections.
Right. I'm just trying to draw a distinction. Here's, you know, an instruction you have suggested, and naturally you're complaining that he didn't put that in, but the wording of the instruction that he finally gives is something different. So how... I mean, maybe if it's verbatim what the government had asked for and you've already objected to that, maybe that's enough to preserve the objection. But if there are any variations at all, it's not crazy to think that he needs to know that the new version is also unacceptable to you.
Well, actually, I do understand your question, and I would respond that if there was a variation and that was the substance of my objection, then I would be required to make a new objection because there's a new issue. But in the case at hand, it wasn't about a variation.
So he just used the government's instructions lock, stop. He used some instruction to which you had already made an objection.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Johnson. Mr. Bass, another return match between you and Ms. Johnson?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, thank you. May it please the Court, Timothy Bass on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, Judge Roldner asked to answer your question directly. There was no objection to the admission of the evidence resulting from the search of the Ash Street residence.
Well, you can help me with this, I bet, because I'm wondering, how is the evidence from Ash Street linked to the crime charged? I mean, it seems like a rather tenuous link occurring 30 days later. I mean, that's not like the cases where there's a time gap in the middle that needs to be explained. You wanted, it seems to me, you wanted this in to show that this defendant was so bold that after he's arrested, he went right back out and started selling drugs again. And, of course, that would be propensity evidence, wouldn't it?
It could be, Your Honor, depending upon the context in which it was admitted. But it's important to point out, first, that the government filed notice of record of its intent to present this evidence and the theory upon which it was to be presented. The district court entered an order approving of the government admitting this evidence, and there was no objection. So from that standpoint, your review is plain error.
Well, what now, was with respect strange, though, why wasn't this charged as part of his criminal activity?
Well, what was charged, Your Honor, was the most serious readily provable offense, which was the possession of the specific amount of crack cocaine, the 50 or more grams, at Johnson Street in
February.
So
this tail end wasn't readily provable, so it's introduced by way of, these nebulous notions of giving the jury the full picture. Seems odd.
Well, that was the theory upon which it was admitted, Your Honor, that we filed notice of before trial, that this was... It was evidence of the defendant's involvement, continuous involvement, with Mr. Collier in selling crack cocaine at various residences in Decatur.
So why wasn't it charged? Why didn't you charge the whole course of his criminal activity with this other fellow? That's what I don't understand.
We could have done that, Your Honor, and in hindsight, maybe we should have done that, but I would suggest to you that that doesn't impact the admissibility question in the first instance. If this evidence was intricately related to the evidence of the charged crimes, then it was appropriately admitted, regardless of whether...
I don't think intricately related does it. I thought the principle underlying these cases was that certain evidence had to be put in, otherwise the jury would be confused, right? That's the basic idea. They wouldn't have the full picture, so they'd be confused. They'd be wondering, well, what about this? What about that loose end? Who is this person who got mentioned? I don't see how that applies when you have when you're talking about subsequent history, subsequent to the crimes charged. Why would the jury have been confused if they hadn't heard this stuff?
Well, Your Honor, one of the factors the court looks at is whether the absence of the evidence would tend to result in jury confusion, but that's not the only...
Well, what's another? I don't understand.
Well, to provide a complete story of the underlying conduct.
I don't understand the
conduct.
Complete story.
What that
suggests is if they don't get the complete story, they're going to be confused, as they're going to make a mistake because they didn't have the complete story. So I don't see complete story as different from confusion. It seems to me it's just multiplying categories. And the real point is, would the jury, not reach a correct result because something significant was being withheld from them?
Your Honor, I'm not going to suggest to you that this evidence was so indispensable as that it would have certainly resulted in jury confusion.
So why isn't it, bad act evidence being introduced without a justification?
Because the lack of evidence being indispensable does not necessarily translate
it
into propensity.
What is
evidence?
The reason for putting it in? Either it's necessary to avert, it seems to me, it's either necessary to avert confusion or it doesn't belong in there.
Well, Your Honor,
and I would add, too, I think Judge Posner hit on something that bothered me a lot. this is evidence after the crime charged. You know, it can't possibly be part of the story of what happened leading up to the crimes that you're charging, because it didn't happen for another month. And, you know, it'd be like saying 3 years out, you know, here's this evidence. So I'm worried about this, the timing, which actually seems to have been mixed up at one point. Didn't you originally say it was just a couple of days, you know, within the time period almost immediately, and then you said, oh, actually it's March 4th?
There was an initial error in stating that the evidence, I believe, was within a week or two.
Yeah, you thought it was like around February the 4th or so, and then you came in and, quote, corrected and said, oh, well, it's really March 4th.
At the beginning of the trial, Your Honor, before this evidence came in. On the first day of trial, after the government had filed notice of its intent to present this evidence, and after the district judge had ruled on its admissibility, the government then, the defendant then on the day of trial, filed a motion to exclude it, not challenging it as 404B evidence, but challenging the government's ability to establish its foundation. And it was during that discussion that the government advised the district court as to the correct date. I mean, but again, even at that point, there was no dispute from the defendant that this was admissible evidence.
I understand that point that you're making, but I guess it certainly undermines my confidence in the district judge's initial ruling. If the district judge thought he was ruling with functionally contemporaneous evidence, it sounds more like part of the full story than if you come in and at the moment of admission say, well, actually, it's a month later. That doesn't look like the same case to me.
Well, Your Honor, my response, again, is twofold. To the appropriateness of this evidence. One, it provided a complete story of the defendant.
But look, that's such mush, right? Complete story, because you could say, well, complete story is this is a bad person. He pulled wings off flies as a child, and this showed that he would likely follow the criminal path, right? Everything's complete. You say a chronological unfolding of events that led to the indictment, but you have the chronology continuing after the events that led to the indictment. It's mush, right?
Well, Your Honor, this court has never drawn a distinction between acts prior to or subsequent as attorney.
I don't understand that, because acts prior, yes, a history, you can understand why a jury wants to know, you know, what led up to this. But what happened after the charged offenses, there may be some curiosity, but why is that important?
Your Honor, the other point that, again, it's simply provided a complete story of continuous conduct between
story stuff. Look, it's bad act evidence. It's inadmissible. Now, if you're going to say complete story, then there isn't going to be any evidence that is inadmissible, because a complete story goes back to the birth and the ancestry of the defendant and the history of the drug laws and everything else, right? That's complete.
I'm not suggesting complete story of the defendant's criminal activity in general, Your Honor, going back to use your example, childhood. All I'm suggesting to you is a complete story within the context of this defendant's sales of crack cocaine with Bradley Collier.
Now, complete story is too vague. It's too vague. It just gives you a blanket permission to put in bad acts evidence.
Well, again, Your Honor, it was evidence within the context only of the defendant's conduct with Mr. Collier. And the second point, Your Honor, as to its appropriateness, goes to corroborating Mr. Collier's testimony. And this court has affirmed that as a permissible ground for admission. We cite U.S. versus Hughes from this court's 2001 decision, where the court said, quote, it directly impacted on the question of the veracity and strength of that testimony, close quote. That testimony meaning referring to the government's witness's testimony.
What was the corroborative evidence?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Collier testified as to his involvement with the defendant in the sales of crack cocaine in Decatur, beginning in 2002 and concluding in 2004, when Mr. Collier described his involvement with the defendant at the Ash Street residence. Again, that testimony was not...
I don't understand. It's like our previous case. How do you corroborate your own evidence? I don't get that.
Mr. Collier testified to his involvement with the defendant.
I know. How does that corroborate his testimony about the offenses in issue? The fact that he testifies about other offenses, how is that corroborative?
It's corroborative of his credibility in general, Your Honor.
I don't understand that. Look, suppose I say you robbed me of you picked my pocket on April 1st, and then you picked it again on May 1st. Well, how does that testimony about May 1st corroborate what I said about April 1st?
Well, if you can show that the government's witness's testimony is credible as to one event, then it's certainly appropriate to draw an inference from that.
But
that
how
it's
do
likely
we know
that
his later testimony is credible? I don't understand. His testimony about the later event, how do we know it's credible? He testifies two times. I mean, corroboration is evidence given by someone else. It's not your own evidence. Not repeating yourself or telling new stories. That doesn't corroborate your old story. Is that your notion of corroboration?
Your Honor, the corroboration was Mr. Collier testified, here's what I did with the defendant.
How does that corroborate what he testified?
I'm not saying that his testimony was the corroborative evidence.
It was the search evidence
that corroborated Mr. Collier's testimony. Mr. Collier testified, here's what I did with the defendant and where during this time frame. I did it at East William. I knew that he dealt and visited the Johnson Street residence. And I knew that he moved then to Ash Street and continued manufacturing crack cocaine, and it was there that I continued to obtain that crack cocaine from the defendant and sell it. And then if you introduce searches of those various residences and find the defendant there and find crack cocaine, I can't conceive of a better example of corroborative evidence.
You're saying the search is the corroboration, not his subsequent evidence.
The evidence that was obtained from the search of the Ash Street residence was the corroboration of Mr. Collier's testimony, and that's the ground which this court has said in Hughes is appropriate, which went to the veracity of Mr. Collier's testimony in the first instance. So, Your Honor, if you reject our argument that it was not...
I don't think I understand that.
I see my time is up,
Your Honor. Because he testified truthfully on one occasion, that corroborates his evidence on another occasion? I don't think that's true. Nobody lies all the time, right?
Oh, I don't know.
You can't present evidence. Look, you can't do this. If you have a witness whose credibility is challenged, you can't say, oh, by the way, on another occasion, this witness told the truth. You can't do that. That's ridiculous. That's like saying, if I testify that you robbed me and you challenged my credibility, I can say, look, I can prove to you that when I applied for a driver's license, I gave my true birth date. Now, would you regard that as corroboration of my testimony that you robbed me? Because I demonstrably told the truth on another occasion?
I think it would certainly be appropriate for us, for the government.
So your answer is no to that case, right?
I'm not sure I understand your hypothetical.
Look, it's extremely clear. My credibility is challenged when I accuse you of a crime. And so to rehabilitate me, the prosecutor says, look, Posner, when he applied for his driver's license, he gave his true date of birth. He told the truth. And since he told the truth on that occasion, that enhances the likelihood that he told the truth when he accused you. Now, would that count as corroborative evidence?
No.
Of course not.
No.
Well, how is this different? The fact that he testified truthfully about something found, you know, outside the indictment period, how does that corroborate his testimony about different events in a different period?
Because on one hand, Your Honor, your example is just an example of the government introducing evidence of a witness's good character. That's not admissible. I concede that. But that's not what happened here. We had Mr. Collier testifying to events that were relevant to the crime charged, and it was certainly appropriate for the government to introduce corroborative evidence to establish that Mr. Collier's testimony regarding those relevant matters was credible.
It's his testimony regarding different matters. Nobody lies about everything. Suppose you have a government informant. He works for the government. He testifies in a multitude of cases. His credibility is challenged in one case. Can the government introduce evidence of all the other times on which he told the truth?
Well, there is a long line of authority in this court, Your Honor, and it's referred to in U.S. versus Scott, which is cited on our brief, that evidence of cooperation of a government witness in other cases is admissible to rebut assertions of bias on the behalf of the defendant. So the answer to your question is dependent upon.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, if we have a situation where a simple control by situation, a distribution, and the government witness testifies and the defense gets up and challenges his bias and say he's a witness in the bag for the government, this court's authority allows the government to then call an agent to say, this witness, this informant, has conducted numerous other controlled transactions, all of which have been successful. That's evidence to corroborate or to bolster the credibility of the government witness. And it depends on the context, Your Honor, and what the defense challenges are to his credibility. And all I'm suggesting to you here is that the corroboration was of a matter relevant to the offense. And again, it was not a miscarriage of justice. For
okay,
those reasons,
well,
we'd ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Bass. Ms. Johnson, does she have any time? 1 minute.
Unless Your Honors have any further questions of me, I would return the balance of my time.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.